Welcome, friend. This is Economic Update, a weekly program on the economic dimensions of our lives, national and international aspects of our work situations, our incomes, our debts, all the things that make up the economic parts of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. I currently teach in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write regular economics columns for truthout.org, a courageous daily source of news and analysis that I urge you to take a look at, truthout.org. Please also know that if you find the discussions and analyses we present on this program of interest, that you can explore them further and look at some of the documents and papers that they are drawn from by consulting our two websites. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info. By going to those two websites, you can elaborate what you get from these programs, you can pursue your interests, but you can also do two other things. You can sign up for a free newsletter that will bring electronically these kinds of things to your attention once a month or so at no cost. And you can also communicate with us at the program, sending us your comments, your questions, your criticisms. And we try to respond to them in select few of them at the end of each program. But we also read and think about all of them in shaping what we cover and how we cover it in this program. So if you're interested, do take a moment. R.D. Wolff, spelled W-O-L-F-F, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. We begin our updates for this program with returning to a country we have talked about often. The country is Greece. And Greece has become a kind of tragic poster child for the mismanagement of our economic system, and in particular, the mismanagement of the crisis that this system is prone to and is now in the middle of. So just to remind you, Greece currently is distinguished by a 27% rate of unemployment. In the depths of the depression, the Great Depression of the United States in the 1930s, particularly in the year 1933, the unemployment rate in the United States was 25%. Cataclysmic, the effects it had. I remember as a young person reading The Grapes of Wrath, the great novel of that time by John Steinbeck, to get a feeling for what the Depression meant for tens of millions of Americans. 25% was the debt. Greece today is worse than that. Try to think and try to have some compassion for what that might mean. And as if to underscore the statistic, for people under 25 years of age, the official unemployment rate in Greece is 65%. So when you find out, if you haven't already, that young people are leaving Greece in record numbers, desperately trying to find work elsewhere in Europe or even further across the globe, you will understand why. An economic system that breaks families up this way, that sends young people on a search for jobs only to discover that the countries to which they are going are struggling with unemployment, not as bad as Greece's, but unemployment nonetheless, and that their prospects are not what they might have imagined, well, then you have a feeling, a sense of Greece. So perhaps you can imagine the stunning news, this last week, last couple of weeks, when it was discovered that one of the ways Greece is trying to cope in it with its government, with its crisis, is not only by a horrific austerity program, cutting jobs, cutting government services, But another way that the government is supposed to come to terms with this is by reducing its budget deficit. That's what austerity people like to do. That's what Mr. Ryan here in the United States and Mr. Boehner of the Republicans are pushing for, and what the Democrats basically allow as well. So in the effort of the Greek government to cut its budget, it is selling government property. Now, you might at first wonder, what does that mean? The government is taking property owned by the people of the country and selling it to private, wealthy buyers, because that's the only people who can buy this. And now it turns out that the people in charge of selling government property are not in bed with, but in the airplane of, the people they're selling to. Let me be specific. The chairman of the privatization agency in Greece, Stelios Stavridis, was exposed by the press taking a ride on the private jet of Dimitrios Melissanides, who turns out to be a participant in a company called Emma Delta, which was just sold a one-third stake in the national lottery that the government sold to them. One-third of it sold it to them. So that private interests are now going to run the lottery. They're going to help set the price of the tickets. They're going to help determine what portion is paid out in prizes and what portion is taken as profits. And they're going to get a third of those profits that used to go to the government to help them do what they do. But the government, having sold a third, will now not get a third of the profits for the years ahead. Does it make a little sense to you? Good. Why would you do that? Well, we have a hint because Mr. Stavridis was caught in the private jet of the person he sold one-third to. And they were both flying to a Greek island where they vacation. Yep. This is a part of all austerities here in the United States, in Britain, everywhere. The selling of property. In Detroit, a city that has declared bankruptcy, they are also selling art objects from the city hall, among others. They're selling the people's property. And in that sale, all kinds of cozy arrangements get made between the agency selling and the private sector gobbling up. The private sector, let's make no mistake, which has refused to pay the taxes it should have and could have, thereby bankrupting the government, which has to then go to the companies that didn't pay taxes and sell to them the public property. And you know how the private enterprises buy it? They use the money that they saved from paying taxes to buy the state outright. Is there something wrong in this picture, do you think? Is there something here that smells badly, maybe? Economic systems like ours breed crises. But the remarkable thing is the very forces, refusal of corporations and the wealthy to pay their fair share of taxes, which is extreme in Greece, as it is in most other advanced capitalist countries. The refusal of corporations and the rich to pay taxes helps to produce a crisis. And the rich and the corporations then use the crisis to give the government money to take people's property using the money they saved from having to pay taxes. You have to shake your head at a system that works this way, and you have to wonder out loud, how much longer can it go? Let me turn next to a couple of short stories that tell you volumes about what is happening to the American economy. And I want to drive this home because it can serve, I hope, as partly an antidote to the burgeoning talk of quote-unquote economic recovery. The recovery in this society, in the United States particularly, affects only a small minority of our people. And that's been true for several years now. For the vast mass of people, the recovery is nowhere in sight. Give you an example. Over the last couple of weeks, it was announced that unemployment in the United States is marginally less than it was. But it's having no economic effect and will have no economic effect because of the following fact, which I need to repeatedly bring to your attention. The jobs lost over the last 5 years are systematically better paying, more secure, and with more benefits than the jobs being created now. So yes, the unemployment is not as bad as it was a year ago, though it's still much worse than it was before this crisis hit. But more important, real wages are keeping a downward tendency, and more important still, people are having to replace good jobs with jobs that pay less, are less secure, and provide fewer benefits. That's why the economic effect of unemployment going down won't show up, because the people getting the jobs don't have any money. They're earning very poorly, and they have no security, and they're anxious about their situation, and they will have a hard time borrowing any more money given the poor jobs that they have, etc., etc. But here are some starker stories. Over the last 2 weeks, it was reported that there is a major problem of wild dogs in Detroit. The management of the dog population has become impossible. The majority of people working in dog management in the city of Detroit have been laid off. Meanwhile, the abandoned houses provide shelter for dogs that can no longer be sustained by their owners who can't afford the care for the dog, the feeding of the dog. The economic crisis creating huge numbers, 50,000 is one estimate, of dogs with no homes and no more any owners who live in abandoned buildings and who have been known now to attack people. The city can't cope. That's the reality of a major American city overrun by wild dogs. Yet another example of a situation out of control. The city of Columbia, South Carolina, has just passed an ordinance over the last couple of weeks, which basically criminalizes the homeless. That's right. It declares that homeless people must leave the downtown area. They don't want tourists, and the employed people of Columbia, South Carolina, to have to set eyes on a person rendered homeless. That's right. The economy cannot provide jobs for tens of millions. The economy cannot provide secure jobs, even for those who have them. The economy has created the homeless problem that didn't exist on this scale 10 years ago. But the blame is falling on the homeless, and they're being told, you must go out of the downtown area, or, here it comes, we will arrest and imprison you because you will be criminals because you haven't left. And what do we have to provide for you? On the outskirts of Columbia, through a partnership with a private charity, the city has a shelter with 240 beds, but the official homeless population is 1,500, six times the number of beds. So what is it exactly they're going to expect? Well, we know what to expect. People won't want to stay in those shelters that the police take them to. So they're going to station police. This is the announcement from the government of Columbia, South Carolina. They're going to station police on the roads back into town to block the homeless. So they're either going to be imprisoned because they stayed downtown, or they're going to be put into an overcrowded, effectively, other kind of prison on the outskirts of town, effectively banished. This is not only a sign of what's happening to large numbers of people in America, but it's also a sign of a society that doesn't know how to cope. Gone is the notion, my goodness, we should find homes. That shouldn't be hard because we have millions of abandoned homes in the United States, people who couldn't afford to stay in them. We have millions of abandoned homes for these homeless people to find shelter in. But in our economic system and in our political system, we can't even ask the question, gee, let's find some homes for the homeless. Let's create some jobs. Let's give these people another chance to make a decent... No, no, no. We are imprisoning them at more expense to the population and at a destruction of them. Have we not learned the lesson of the past? Don't we know that if you put homeless people into a prison, their situation becomes worse, their capacity to recover and find a useful place in society shrinks, and that it costs the rest of us the money to imprison? This is a lose-lose proposition. And that the good people of South Carolina can't do better, and the city fathers of Columbia can't do better than this, speaks about a society falling apart by an economic system that doesn't work and a political system that can't cope with a dysfunctional economic system. Dogs in Detroit and criminalized homeless in South Carolina are powerful evidences of something that isn't working. Let me turn now to some of the more major discussions that I want to have with you in this program and bring some of these items to your attention. I want to begin with a story about universities and students. This is an extremely important issue for many reasons. It's no exaggeration to say that the future of the United States is in many ways shaped by the proportion, a large proportion of our young people that go to colleges and universities of one kind or another to beef up on their capabilities, their self-confidence, their knowledge, so that they can be more productive and more effective in what they do. So how we treat them and how we handle our student population, again, tells you much about what's happening in this society. And I would argue, as I have in the previous minutes of this program, that we're not doing real well and that recovery is not the word you want to use. Let's begin. We have had, as you all know, an economic crisis since 2007. And it has affected colleges and students in particular ways that I want to now focus your attention on. First, it has made for a generation of desperate young people. Here's what I mean. As the job situation has deteriorated, as either their parents have lost jobs or their parents have held on to jobs but discovered that they now pay less, or are less secure, or have fewer benefits, or all of that, young people are realizing that they're going to have a hard time, that they are getting ready to enter a job market that is grim with the spectacle of unemployment, reduced benefits, reduced security, extraordinary. And that has frightened our young people so that they are more desperate than ever to get a college education, not so much because of what they might learn, but because they must have that credential, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, an associate's degree, a PhD degree, because it gives them, they hope, a leg up in the competition to get any kind of job, let alone a good one. So you have a desperate group of people moving into universities in increasing numbers, in many cases, because they want that benefit, that help in getting their careers off to a decent start. At the same time, the crisis, because so many people are unemployed, so many people are earning less than they used to, is paying less taxes into our 50 states. And our 50 states are the major source of money for the state universities and college systems, where the vast majority of our student population goes. Higher education is a public enterprise in the United States, overwhelmingly. The private enterprise is for the few. So with the states strapped for money because of the economic crisis, they have been giving less money to the state universities. So let's see. The way our efficient capitalist system works is it the crisis of that system is driving more and more young people to want and need a college education, at the same time that it diminishes the resources states are providing to the colleges and universities where most young people can expect to find a college education. This doesn't work well, and it produces bizarre outcomes. Here they are. As there are more and more students who want and need a college education in their desperate search for decent jobs, and the state provides less, what has happened? Well, the colleges and universities have responded, both the private and the state, although the state is the place where the crunch comes. The private are just riding on the situation. As good jobs become harder and harder, the elite colleges and universities can charge whatever they want, as young people are desperate to get that elite education, to get the degree from the Harvard or the Yale or wherever it is that will give them a leg up. So the private schools can jack up their prices the way the state schools have. Across the board, the state universities and colleges have responded to restricted help from the state governments, who have no money in a crisis economy that doesn't raise taxes on rich people, so it doesn't find the money. So the states cut back on the colleges. The colleges raise the tuition. Let's see. How does this work? The colleges raise the tuition to make up for the money that the state isn't providing and to take advantage of the desperate students who have really no choice but to pay the rising tuition. Oh, here's another way this economic system works out to damage large numbers of people. But the story isn't done. The colleges have taken another tack. If the states give them less money, they're going to get cheaper teachers. Here's how this works. You stop having what are called tenure-track jobs, places where you hire a professor, and you look at him or her for a few years, you give them tenure, they have a reasonable teaching load, they have the time to keep up with their field, to study the literature, and to be as good teachers as possible. No, you get rid of that. You have instead what's called an adjunct. This is a person usually out of graduate school recently, and you pay them a tiny fraction of what you used to pay your regular tenured professor. The only way this person can then live is by teaching half a dozen of these courses in two or three universities wherever he or she happens to live. You're getting away with saying to them, look, there are no tenure-track jobs left. Why not? Because you're not offering any. Instead, these are the only kinds of jobs your PhD will now qualify you for. And if you don't want this, go drive a cab. So young people coming out of our universities are increasing numbers becoming adjuncts. They have no job security. They are not eligible for many of the benefits that tenured professors have and have always had. And they are paid at a small fraction of what a regular professor gets paid. I see this in my own life. I'm part of the older generation that had a tenure-track job most of my life. And I'm surrounded by my own students who can't get those jobs. So the university saves money by having young people working too many jobs, unable, therefore, of course, to keep up with the literature, no time to learn and develop their knowledge. It's not good for education. It's not good for the students. It is driven by money. By the lack of money coming from state governments strapped by the crisis, who turn around and solve this problem by hiring young people as adjuncts. A bad solution to a bad problem. Last step. Young people, desperate for work, whether they go to a private school hoping to get an elite job, or they go to a public college or university hoping to have a leg up on those who can't afford to go. This is a desperate collection of people. They can't question shifting to adjuncts from real professors. paying people too little to enable them to do the job they trained to do, the young people. They want to be good professors, but you have to pay them to enable them to do it, like with anything else. The young people who are going to school, they don't question what's happening with adjuncts. They're grateful to be in the school. And they don't question the rising tuition. What choice have they got, they feel. So what do? They go and they borrow money to pay the high tuition. And they're borrowing now mostly from the federal government. So this crazy society has a crisis that hobbles the ability of the state government, which was doing a fine job funding higher education. So now it's funded instead by the federal government, but not by the federal government directly helping the college. That might be rational. No. Instead, the federal government gives loans to the students, hobbling them with a new generation of young people hobbled with enormous amounts of debt as the price of the education they want and need, not only to help themselves, but to build our society. This is an educational, an economic, a personal, and an ethical disaster. Young people willing and able to study should not be hobbled with these conditions. They should not have adjuncts. Those adjuncts should be given proper pay and job conditions. They should not have to overload with debt. It's an insane way of handling this problem. This is a society whose economic system is so dysfunctional that the dysfunction is spreading. It's metastasizing into the educational system that will have negative consequences for this country's future for decades to come. It shows a system that does not work. We're going to take a short break in the middle of our program today. Please stay with me. This is Richard Wolff. The program is Economic Update, and I'll be back with you in a short moment. Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to remind you again, as we go through some of our major topics for today's program, that you can pursue your interests in these areas, get much more material made available to you along these lines by visiting either of our two websites. The first is R.D. Wolff, spelled W-O-L-F-F, rdwolff.com. And the other one is Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info, I-N-F-O. Those two websites will not only provide you with more material freely available to you as you wish, but it will also provide you with two other useful things. Number one, you can sign up for our newsletter. Once a month, you will get delivered to you by email a sample of the kinds of materials that you will find on the website. In other words, we bring it to you. It'll be both material of interest and a reminder of what's available on the website. And the second thing you can do is send an email to us here at Economic Update so that we can get a better sense of what topics you would like us to deal with on this program, and that we can select a very few, because we can't handle otherwise the many that you send us, a few questions that we will address towards the end of each program. So do please take advantage of that service on either of the two websites. I want to return now to the larger discussions rather than the short updates with which we begin our programs by talking to you about a remarkable item that strikes me as extraordinarily interesting in our environment today. This has to do with the city of New Haven, Connecticut. And I want to talk briefly with you about New Haven, Connecticut, because while it has some specific problems that are unique to it, every city does, it also has some general problems that I think you will find interesting no matter where you live. New Haven is a large city by American standards. It has about 125,000 people in it. It's been around a long time. It's part of the early history of the United States in New England, first settled by the British many, many years ago. And it has a number of famous things about it. Probably the most well-known has to do with a major American university, Yale University, which is located in New Haven, Connecticut, where it started 300-odd years ago. And when it started, I might mention, it was started as a school for training Protestant ministers. The idea was that the people in Connecticut, and there weren't all that many, who had come over from Great Britain were mostly Protestant, and they wanted to be able to set up local Protestant churches, but they had nobody to be a minister. And so they wanted a school to be set up that would train people to be Protestant ministers so they could serve in the churches in and around New Haven in the state of Connecticut and thereby be a service to the community. So Yale was set up to perform that service, and Yale was provided with something I'm going to talk about as we go on. It was provided with a tax exemption. That is, the argument was made, look, if the school has to pay taxes for the property it occupies, for the buildings in which it trains these young men to be ministers, because they didn't train young women, well, then it's going to be hard going, and let's do them a favor and give them tax exemption. They are doing something that the whole community will benefit. And so the whole community said, you don't have to pay taxes. We will provide you, the School of Yale, with local services. If there's a fire, we will come and put the fire out. And if you need police services of one kind or another, the community will provide them. And of course, it costs the community money to provide police and fire and a public school to train the children of the people who work at Yale. But we will cover those costs. You don't have to pay your share. You don't have to pay the taxes that would otherwise pay the police people and the fire people and the school teachers, because you're providing a service for the community, training our young ministers, so we'll give you a tax exemption. Thank you, said Yale. They took the tax exemption, and they have held on to it ever since. Fast forward to now. Over the last few weeks, a number of rating agencies have said that the rating of the bonds, the debts of New Haven, have been lowered. It's becoming riskier and riskier to lend money to New Haven. You know why? Because New Haven's economy is in trouble. You know why? Because it's part of the capitalist system in the United States, which is in trouble across the board. Detroit is an extreme example, but New Haven is on its way. Whether it'll get to the condition of Detroit, we all hope not, but that's the direction in which New Haven is moving. And that's shown by the cutting of the rates of the credit agency, because New Haven doesn't look like it's able to raise the money to function as a city. It's having to face cutbacks. It's having to face emergencies. And there are all kinds of discussions. Who should be cut back? Should you cut the pensions of the former city workers who gave a lifetime of work to the city? Should you cut the salary or the benefits or the pensions of the school teachers and police and fire workers today? All those kinds of questions are now urgent in New Haven and being discussed. But I want to make this point about that issue. There is a kind of an elephant in the room that no one is recognizing is sitting there, even though the aroma and the sheer bulk are affecting everybody. The issue in New Haven is Yale. Just like the issue in Detroit was the auto companies, the big elephant. Are you going to make them pay a reasonable share of maintaining the city? Are you going to make them responsible in Detroit, not to simply get up and leave empty factories with weeds growing in the warehouses with no responsibility to take care of the decimated families and communities, or not? In Detroit, the answer was, or not. And in New Haven, the answer so far has been, in relationship to Yale, a similar, or not. But Yale is the grotesque elephant. Let me explain. Yale is a multi-billion dollar enterprise. It has tens, $20 billion of assets in its endowment fund. It does $1 or $2 billion worth of business a year. And I mean business, not just getting the money from students. That's now a small part of them. They run hospitals all over the Northeast. They're a big business. Big business. But they pay no taxes on 95% of the property in New Haven. Let's go over this. They're the largest employer in the city of New Haven, sort of like the auto companies in Detroit. They're the largest landowner in the city of New Haven, sort of like the oil companies in the city of Detroit. But they don't pay taxes on 95% of the more than 200 buildings in New Haven that they own and operate. They pay only a tiny amount of money on the few non-educational properties. They don't even pay taxes on their golf course, the largest single unit of property that they own in the middle of New Haven. By the way, do any classes take place at the golf course? No. Does any education go on at the golf course? No. Perhaps other than training you in how to hit a golf ball. How did Yale get away with paying no taxes on that? They explained to the city some years ago that they need to have a golf course to entertain the rich people from whom they beg money to help pay for the schooling in another part of town. Wow. And that worked? Yeah, that worked. That got them out of paying taxes. The solution to New Haven's problem has always been, for the last 100 years, the same one. Make Yale pay. When someone has a problem with the police in New Haven, who works at Yale or who's a student at Yale, they rely on not just the Yale police, but the New Haven police. And when there's a problem with fire, the New Haven Fire Department comes. And when the city of New Haven cleans the air so it's safer for people to breathe, that's good for Yale professors and Yale students and Yale administrators, too. And when the children of Yale employees and Yale students go to the public school, they draw upon the costs that the city, in other words, the city is spending an enormous amount of money providing services of all kinds to the Yale community, usually estimated at 15,000 to 17,000 people out of a population of 125. But they don't pay for the services they get. Let's recapitulate. New Haven is listed by the U.S. Census Department as among the 10 poorest cities, poorest large cities in the United States. It has been on the poverty list a long time. It is the home of the third or fourth richest university, perhaps on earth, but certainly in the United States. One of the poorest cities in America, let's get this straight now, one of the poorest cities in America delivers free public services to one of the richest universities in the country. There's only one phrase to capture this. Robin Hood in reverse. Stealing from the poor to help the rich. The reverse of what Robin Hood was famous for. What kind of a society allows a community of 125,000 to tax itself very high to pay for the services it delivers to a wealthy university for free? You have to take a step back, scratch your head, and remember you're in the United States of America, where this kind of reverse Robin Hood is now typical. The people of Detroit made the car companies work, and the car companies paid them back by decimation. Decimation illustrated by the story earlier in this hour about the dog problem in Detroit. Yale is an institution ostensibly committed to higher education, to education, to the civilizing effect of education. But the truth is, they're decimating the schools of New Haven because they run on city money. And the city doesn't have enough money. And so the city is in trouble. Oh, it's not as bad in New Haven schools as it now is in Philadelphia schools that are literally collapsing. We have noted that in earlier programs a month ago. But New Haven is moving in that direction. There's no need for it. The resources at Yale are more than enough to help the city in the ways that it should have been doing for 100 years. But they don't. And so the city is left wondering whether it ought to stick it to these pensioners or to these school children or to close the library more hours or to not take care of the public parks even more than they are already doing. Sad, tragic, and there's no excuse. Let me turn now to a story that I found, frankly, almost beyond belief. One of you sent me a question, and this was a question about taxes and the tax situation here in the United States. And what was unbelievable was that there was still, after all the discussions we've had about this on this program, but in the mass media, a confusion about the taxes that working people in the United States are required to pay. So let me address that with you. Most American working people are required to pay two basic kinds of taxes on their income. They pay an income tax to the federal government, and they pay what's called a payroll tax. Those are taxes on your income. Please keep them separate from the taxes you pay at other moments in your life. Not when you're getting an income from your employer, but, for example, when you're buying a shirt, then you pay a sales tax. Or if you own your own home, you pay a property tax to the community where the home is located. We're putting those other kinds of taxes aside. Most Americans pay lots of different kinds of taxes. If you hear someone say, oh, I am double taxed, tell them they're very lucky. Most of us are triple, quadruple taxed. But on our income, on that particular activity, earning your income, for most of us, the wage or the salary we live on, there are two taxes attached to that by the federal government. I'm going to put aside the possibility that your income is also taxed by the state government and the local government. That can happen in parts of the United States, in many parts. But we're just now going to talk about the federal government in Washington and its two kinds of taxes on our income. The first is an income tax, okay? And that works as follows. The lowest rate is 10%. So everybody pays the low rate of 10% on roughly the first, I'll look it up for you so I can give it to you. Yes. For the first $9,000 that you earn, everybody pays 10%. Okay? For the next chunk, everything you earn from $9,000 to $36,000, you pay 15%. For everything from $36,000 to $87,000, you pay 25%. So it goes up like that. If you earn more than $400,000 a year, you pay the top tax, which is 39.6%. Whether you earn $400,000 or $1 million or $200 million or $300 million, you pay 39.6%. It doesn't go up anymore after that. This is a wonderful benefit to rich people because, of course, we could keep raising it. For example, we could say if you earn between $400,000 and $1 million, you pay 39.6%. But if you earn between $1 million and $2 million, you pay 47% on that. And then between $2 million and $8 million, 61%. And by the way, how do I know we could do that? Because that's what we used to do. Back in the 50s and 60s, the top bracket, the income tax rate paid by those at the top was as high as 94% in the 1940s, 91% in the 1950s and 60s. So there's absolutely no reason and no justification for the income tax to be at 39.6%. That is wonderful for rich people who earn millions, that it doesn't keep going up. That's great for them. It's useless for us. It's useless for us. One more time. It's useless for us. It benefits them. It doesn't benefit us. And you ought to wonder with me how we got a tax system to be so different now from what it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. If it was appropriate to tax rich people at higher rates then, how exactly did it become less appropriate now that the rich people are much richer than they were back then? The second kind of tax you pay is a payroll tax. That's not the income tax. The payroll tax is completely different. It's a flat rate. It's the same whether you earn $2,000 a year or you earn up to $113,000 a year. Whatever you earn in that range, from nothing to $113,000, you pay the same percentage. We all pay the same, and that's the money that goes into the Social Security system and the Medicare system. That's what the money is that then will be used to pay our Social Security benefits and cover our Medicare care after we're 65 years of age, roughly. Okay? Those are the two different kinds of taxes we pay. Now, you may be asking, and I hope you are, what happens if you earn more than $113,000? As rich people, of course, do. And the answer is, there is no payroll tax on anything you earn over $113,000 a year. So, for example, let's suppose you earned, just hypothetically, $115,000 a year. You would pay the payroll tax on the first $113,000, but on the last $2,000, nada, no tax, no payroll tax. You still have to pay your income tax, but not your payroll tax. So the richer you are, the more of your income is not subject to the payroll tax. So let me put these two together. The income tax benefits rich people by not having the brackets go up, the rates go up, beyond the maximum of 39.6, even though in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we had rates of 70, 80, and 90%. And the other good news for the rich people is that the payroll tax, what pays for Social Security and Medicare, only covers the first $113,000. Anything you earn beyond that is exempt from payroll tax. So the income tax is really good news for rich people, and the payroll tax is really good news for rich people. And it's not good news for you. And you ought to wonder about that, don't you think? Just a little? And here's a further thought. If you made the payroll tax cover not just the first $113,000, but all the income, all the way to the top, you would suddenly bring the Social Security system a vast new flood of revenue, meaning that all the scary talk about how Social Security doesn't have enough money or Medicare isn't enough disappears. Because you did what? Because you finally taxed wealthy people at the same rate that everybody else pays. And then that money would come in to Social Security and solve its problems and take care of all those Americans who've given a lifetime of labor and want to retire at 65 and get the modest benefits that come from that. And ditto with Medicare, providing a Social Security health care that is normal in all other countries for all ages, but in this country is limited to people over 65, at least so far. Our tax system is a travesty on the most elemental notions of economic justice. It is a tribute to the right wing and to conservatives that they can make a case that Americans find persuasive that taxes are too high. The answer is not that taxes are not too high. The answer is taxes are too high on the average people, and they're way below where they used to be, where they could be, and by all ethical commitments ought to be, which is much higher on those most able to pay, who have gotten away with a tax avoidance of stunning dimensions for the last 40 years. In the time that remains in today's program, I wanted to bring to your attention a remarkable workers' co-op. This is something I have done in past programs. We don't do it every program, but I want to again explain that the purpose of this is to make everyone aware of the creativity, the ingenuity, and the success that it can be had by people who don't want to reproduce the kind of enterprise that is the norm in the American society, the enterprise in which a handful of major shareholders select a board of directors that makes all the decisions that the average person has to live with who works in an enterprise, even though he or she had no participation in making that decision. You know, we made a revolution in the United States back in 1774, 5, and 6 in order to establish that you can't have a decision you live with the consequences of unless you also participate in it, that that's undemocratic. Interesting, if it's undemocratic to have a political decision without you having a say in who makes that decision and what that decision is, then how did it ever become possible to do that economically? Why is it possible in the workplace to have people making decisions we live with without participating, even though that isn't possible down the street in the neighborhood where we live? Well, let me tell you about another one. Beyond Care is the name of a cooperative child care service. It is owned and run by a collection of women. They operate in Brooklyn, in that borough of the city of New York. Many of them are immigrants who have had a hard time finding work, just as they had a hard time finding quality daycare for their own children. So they got together and decided to, you might say, achieve two goals with one act: provide themselves with decent work in an environment they could believe in, while at the same time providing a really important resource for other working families like themselves. So they produced something called the Beyond Care Co-op in Brooklyn. It is a great success. It's been going since June of 2008. I don't have the time to go into detail about all the things they do, but you can find them on the web, where you can learn a great deal more about them. They are licensed and so forth here in the state of New York, and they are a testimony to what people who have more than the average number of disadvantages, whether that be in language or in all the upsets that go with moving from one part of the world to another and losing the connections with your families and communities. So they have a lot of extra obstacles. Nonetheless, they have found that a worker co-op is the way to both serve a community, serve yourself, create a job situation where you look forward to going every day rather than dreading the experience. And so I wanted to bring their heroic story, in this case, a women's working co-op, to your attention so that if you're interested, you can find out more about them. Let me conclude today's program then with urging you to think about the kinds of issues that shake this economy. Please do not be misled by news stories about recoveries and glowing stories. I noticed, for example, that President Obama is about to deliver a speech in which he's going to tell us what he's going to do for college students. What college students need is a radical change in a system so that it isn't fraught with crisis and so that the crisis does not bring them into the awful past that we talked about at the beginning of this show. So be courageous, be skeptical, and I hope that you join us next week when we will once again have Economic Update. This is your host, Richard Wolff, looking forward to speaking with you again then. Gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.